Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hi, everybody. Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio today on this Medical Monday is Dr. Daniel Brox, an ophthalmologist with Hudson Valley Eye Surgeons in Fishkill and the director of ophthalmology at Vassar Brothers Medical Center in Poughkeepsie. Dr. Brox specializes in LASIK, corneal transplants, and general ophthalmic care, and is one of the few ophthalmologists in New York trained in DSAC, an alternative to traditional cornea transplant. He also started the dry eye clinic at Hudson Valley Eye Surgeons. Dr. Brox earned his medical degree at Tufts University School of Medicine. He completed his internship at Mount Auburn Hospital at Harvard University and his residency at the North Shore Long Island Jewish Hospital System. He also completed his fellowship at Mount Sinai, specializing in cornea, external disease, and refractive surgery. He's a member of the American Academy of Ophthalmology and the American College of Surgeons. Welcome back. Great to see you.
Thank you for having me again.
Daniel, let me start by asking you this. When you say DSAC, what is that?
Well, one of the less commonly discussed disorders we see in the eye are disorders of the cornea, and that's the very front surface of the eye.
Right.
So much like the lens, when the lens gets cloudy inside the eye, that's a cataract, the cornea can get cloudy on the front of the eye and cause similar symptoms, not quite as common. So when that cornea does get cloudy for a variety of reasons, we remove the cornea tissue and replace it with a new cornea. And there's varying layers of the cornea, basically the front, the middle, and the back. The traditional approach to replacing the cornea to get a new clear cornea is to remove the entire cornea, front to back. However, that traditional surgery, which has been around almost 100 years, takes a long time to recover from. It can take up to 1 year to regain the vision that you're looking for. So that's a long process. Many visits, removing sutures, takes a lot of time in the office. DSEC, the alternative now, is a partial transplant. There are certain diseases of the cornea, which we know only the very inside layer of the cornea is the problem. Before, despite that knowledge, we had to remove the entire cornea, let it heal for a year. Now we can actually just remove the very thin inner layer of the cornea, replace it with an inner layer of a cornea that's transplanted, and the recovery can be as quick as 6 to 8 weeks. Where we regain the vision. So essentially a partial cornea transplant.
Well, and where do these corneas that are transplanted come from?
Well, these are, thankfully, in this day and age, we have very generous people who are donating their corneas, whether it be on the back of their driver's license or elsewhere indicating that they would like to donate their corneas.
1-800-348-2551. Your chance of asking this brilliant ophthalmologist a question is right now, and right now, not one of those phones is ringing. But by the end, let me tell you, everyone will be, and you won't be out, and you'll be calling me up and saying to me, you're a terrible man, you didn't take my telephone call. So that's it. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. So what's a dry eye?
This is a very important topic these days that is starting to get more of the attention that it deserves. I think in the past, if you go back about 10 years or so, people would come in and say, my vision's blurry or my eyes are irritated. And the answer from the ophthalmologist for any eye doctor would be, well, that's just kind of the way it is. I don't know.
Sure.
That's how it is now. Your eyes are going to be irritated and your vision's not as good as it used to be. But more and more, we're learning that the surface of the eye is becoming dry or rough, and that causes clouding of the vision. And it's a topic that I spend a lot of time and certainly would like to speak to people about today if they have questions, because there are so many things we can do about it. And to discern what is causing the dry eye actually takes a fairly comprehensive exam where I have a specific exam set aside for almost an hour with patients to discern what the issue is causing their dry eye symptoms.
Okay, great. Well, guess what? All the phones are ringing. We've got one more. So let's start with Rich in Wilton. Okay, Rich, you're on. Go.
Hello, doctor. Question. I have contact lenses plus 4.25 in one eye and 1.25 in the other eye, both plus. Is there any other options I have where I can get rid of contacts, some type of corrective surgery, so to speak?
Right, so that's a great question. And when we talk about corrective surgery, we really have certain options, that some of which you're very much aware of. One is just in correcting the prescription is glasses and contact lenses, which obviously you're doing. And after that, we have surgical options. So if we want to get something permanent, our options are really twofold for people. One is laser vision correction, where a laser essentially etches your prescription right on the surface of your eye onto your cornea. And two is a surgery inside the eye. Unfortunately, when we look at laser vision, there are certain prescriptions that cannot be treated because the laser just cannot adequately correct that prescription. A plus 4.25 unfortunately fits into that category where laser vision is not going to do a good job and is going to unfortunately give you very distorted vision or not adequately correct that vision. So the option then becomes something inside the eye, which is an intraocular surgery, which you are taking on a little more risk. We actually don't do that in our office because we feel the risk outweighs the benefit. But essentially what you'd be doing is going in the eye, replace the lens of the eye with a new lens with the prescription, as you stated, to try to give you that permanent vision that you're looking for. For us, we tend to shy away from surgery inside the eye unless we absolutely have to, because there is higher risk to just get rid of glasses. It doesn't seem that the risk and benefit evens out, in our opinion there. But there are certainly people that do that.
But when you get a cataract, I had cataract operation, you come out with the perfect vision, don't you?
Exactly right. So that's what I always tell people. So for now, perhaps not the best choice for you. But in the future, an added bonus is if you do get cataracts, hopefully you don't, but if you do, an added bonus will be you can choose whatever prescription you want to implant there. If you want to do the plus 425 in one side and the plus 125 in the other, that's certainly available to you, meaning you can set your eyes at distance or near as you please when you have those cataracts.
The only problem I had is...
Yeah,
go ahead.
My prescription for my contacts changes almost every year, where it gets a little bit more aggressive as far as the readings that I get back. If they do that surgery, would that still be an issue where my vision would change and something would have to be corrected?
Well, let me ask you two quick questions. What is your age?
70.
And you have not had cataract surgery yet?
No, sir.
So essentially the reason the prescription's changing for you most likely at this point is because the lens in the eye is getting a little bit of cataract, meaning what happens first is the lens changes shape and changes size a little, and that's what makes our prescription change. So once somebody has cataract surgery, you're set at whatever you're set at, meaning that lens won't keep changing because it's been removed.
Okay, Rich, got to let you go.
Thank
you very much. Okay, let's go to Susan in Schenectady. Susan, you're on.
Hi. I have a 2-year-old relative who has a cyst on the outside of his lower lid, and he went to his general doctor, and there was an indication that he was too young to have any treatment. I was wondering if that's the general practice or the best practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends, of course, on what the cyst is. And the most common type of cyst, really, or bump on the lid would be a chalazion, which just basically means one of the glands on the eyelid has gotten swollen and clogged. A lot of the time, these can go away on their own. If that's what it is, some general ophthalmologists will not feel comfortable removing things on the lids that don't have to be removed at that age. But if it's persistent, irritating, or sometimes can affect the vision, certainly it can be removed. And the specialist you're going to want to look for to do that for you at that age would be an oculoplastics specialist. So that's an ophthalmologist that actually specializes in surgery in and around the eyelids, and they are doing that regularly.
Can I ask you this? It wasn't an ophthalmologist. It was a general practitioner, doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Is it best practice to get an opinion from an ophthalmologist or the type that you're talking about before making a decision?
Oh, absolutely. So I didn't understand that you hadn't seen the ophthalmologist yet. That's certainly going to want to be a stop for you first, and they will likely refer you to the oculoplastics doctor depending on their experience with such things, but that would be most of the time the way to go.
Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Bye. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
So Support comes from the Urological Institute Urologic Oncology Services, prostate cancer specialists providing comprehensive care for all stages of prostate cancer, featuring 3D diagnostic imaging and advanced robotics, urologyoncology.com. Haydenville Woodworking and Design, a group of artisans designing and building renovations, additions, new homes, custom cabinets, and furniture for over 30 years. HaydenvilleWD.com for virtual portfolio. The Eagle Hill School, Hardwick, Massachusetts, a college preparatory boarding and day school specializing in learning disabilities and ADD. Open house October 16th, ehs1.org for information. And from the Ashokan Center, a classroom in the wild where nature inspires conferences, festivals, family celebrations, and outdoor education for schools. AshokanCenter.org.
And we are back, and as a result of being back, we're going, Daniel, if it's okay, to Marie in Schenectady. Marie, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Shartok, Alan. Dr. Brock, I have a question about cataracts. I have cataracts. I can still drive. I don't have a disease related to the eyes, and I've had cataracts for about 5 years now, difficulty driving at night. Question is, Alan would remember this. I no longer have chronic kidney disease, allergic reaction caused nephrotic syndrome. 7 long years, but I am free, and I had to take prednisone for a long time. What is the story insofar as someone who has cataracts, and I see an ophthalmologist in Albany, but I'm scared because I know they would do he would do one eye at a time, but what is the story where they use the liquid derivative of the corticosteroid? And I was on prednisone a long time, toxicity and all the rest, but I no longer have chronic kidney disease.
Okay, you
so
said
what's
that.
The story for on cataracts and the insertion of the intraocular lens?
So that's a great question. Now, cataracts, just in general speaking, first I mentioned already, is when the lens in the eye gets cloudy over time, and mm-hmm. not a person comes into my office that doesn't at least have a little bit of cloudiness. So then we go to the most important question, and really the only important question is, how are the cataracts affecting our vision day to day? So if I tell a person they have some cataract, they have to then tell me how they're doing day to day. So if they say to me, I'm doing great, are you doing the things you enjoy day to day without difficulty? Yes, I'm doing fine. Then that's the end of the appointment. There's no reason to pursue it further. However, if our vision, the quality of our vision, is getting in the way of our everyday activities, then it's worth pursuing.
Or every night activity.
Or every night activities, which is a good point. Now, the night vision and night driving, that's one of the most visually demanding things there is. So that is when people will notice it first.
Horrible. Yeah.
Absolutely. So it depends. For instance, if I have, which I have frequently come in, a truck driver who drives at night in unfamiliar areas comes in with a cataract, they're going to be noticing that much earlier than someone that doesn't have that occupation, and they're going to have surgery much earlier than a person that does not have that occupation. But if I have someone that comes in, I say, you have medium cataracts, and they say, I'm doing great, doc. Everything looks clear to me. I don't really know what you're talking about. Then that's the end of the story. The thing that matters is how a person's doing day to day.
And what about the intervening variables that Marie spoke about, you know, the prednisone and all the rest?
That's important. There are intervening variables. The most common type of cataract is the long name of it, age-related cataracts, which just means over time our eyes, the lens in the eye gets a little cloudy, but there are other things that can cloud the lens. Corticosteroids is on the top of that list too, certainly causes a certain part of the lens to be cloudy.
Interesting.
So the eye surgeon can tell you exactly, yes, this is from your steroid, or no, it's not likely from your steroid. The other things, other medications certainly can do it. And on the list of systemic issues, diabetes is high up there as well as the common things that can cause that lens to get cloudy.
Can I say just a little bit more? All of the things you discussed with the ophthalmologist and early on, insofar as the corticosteroids, knowing, having read a hell of a lot, insofar as just what Dr. Shartok appointed there. So my vision is okay. Reading, yes, it's affected, but there are other things in my life too, the stress with the spouse. So are you saying that if you can go on for a long time, or eventually you have to face up to perhaps having one or both of the eyes with the intraocular lens, I can abandon the driving at night, but it's
Okay, but Marie, we got that part. But what I want to ask a doctor here is this. Is Marie, I mean, to me, if it was just a question of cataracts, you do it. You just do it. I did it, and
exactly.
I didn't look back. But she has these other things, and you're thinking that that she's over that?
It took them 4 or 5 years, Alan, and the person that took care of me at Albany Med, she had a stroke. My mentor, you know, everything. And you and I talked with Dr. Pettit a hell of a lot many times with him insofar as the issue. Only take Avapro.
Well,
listen, right,
it's always going to be an anxiety provoking thing to have an eye surgery, but if the vision isn't adequate, it certainly is a low risk procedure and the appropriate thing to
because
do.
Because I'm allergic, lidocaine and Celestone.
Of course,
we found out. So what do I do? Is that something where the ophthalmologist will say, well, enough said. This ophthalmologist, he said, well, Marie, we wouldn't do anything. Wait a minute. Come on.
Well,
already.
Right. This, of course, is what...
So what happened?
Whoa, Marie, let him talk.
No, that's okay. So this, of course, is what a good doctor is for. When we see you, we do not just look at the fact that there's a cataract. There are a whole slew of things to make sure it's a safe procedure for you, and they should certainly give you all the risks and discuss that with you prior to having
Marie,
surgery.
Marie, gotta go. Thank you. Okay, let's go to Lars in Chatham. Okay, Lars, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So I have actually an appointment with an ophthalmologist on Friday, but I thought I'd ask ahead of time. Eye floaters.
Oh.
Okay.
Now you're talking.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I am aware of them. I've educated myself, but, you know, do they have to be a normal part of aging, nearsightedness? What's the deal?
Right. So that's a great question because it's a very common question, a common issue that people have. And basically, there's two types of floaters. There's the very common one you're probably referring to here. The eye is filled with a gel. It's called the vitreous gel. And the very back surface of the eye is the retina. That's like wallpaper back there. When we're born, that gel is stuck right up against that wallpaper, the retina. And over time, that gel starts to loosen up and move around a little bit and get a little more liquidy, get some bubbles in it and some lines and things. And that's what we start to see as that gel changes shape and changes consistency. Unfortunately, a normal thing. Now, we do want to differentiate that from the type of floater that's not good. So if we're sitting around and all of a sudden we see a ton of new floaters or all sorts of new floaters in our vision, this can be a sign that that retina, that wallpaper in the back surface of the eye, has gotten a little tear in it and released little pieces into that gel.
So what
and
do
that's what
that?
You're seeing. So if you see new floaters or you're seeing a change in floaters, you want to go right in to see the ophthalmologist.
No, I get that. But do you use a laser or something like
exactly.
that?
Exactly. So then you see that ophthalmologist and they can use, for a smaller tear, a laser right in the office, or a larger tear, or what we fear, a retinal detachment, which means that whole retina comes loose, that needs surgery. And all those are very important to fix as soon as possible. So there's not a great solution to the average everyday floater that most people are dealing with yet, but for the type of floater that's caused by a retinal tear or detachment, that can be very serious to the vision. So we want to be able to differentiate those things.
And sometimes they just go away, right?
Yeah, right. So thankfully, a lot of them do just go away, or our brain is a very smart thing.
Right.
Though when I look in there, I actually see some of these pockets of fluids and spots, and the person says they're gone. The brain has learned to ignore them and to make it so that you don't see them anymore.
That's what happened to me. Thank you very much, Laura.
Let me ask you. So it's not, you know, I had these as a child, and I didn't realize everyone didn't have them. I was almost, you know, quite a bit into adulthood before I thought to, you know, make mention. But, so a couple of years ago, suddenly I realized, boy, I have an awful lot of them all. But they've never increased, and that's just the way it is. Is that the deal? There's just,
right. Well, that's the key, that they're not increasing, and unfortunately, not a solution for it right now, but I will caution you, and I have a lot of patients unfortunately spend money on this. There are drops you can find on the internet and even pills you can find on the internet that say they get rid of floaters, but it unfortunately is a scam. But hopefully someday I would love to have an eye drop or something like that that relieve those floaters.
Lars, thank you. Okay, and I have to say, you know, there's another kind of floater. They pick them out of the Hudson River every once in a while.
That is true.
Okay, and we've got a John in Boysville. Okay, John, you're on.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'll make this real quick. I know there's probably a bunch of people waiting.
You're on.
Cataracts. Removal of a cataract. Can it be done with a laser? And also, does a lens have to be put in afterwards, or will there be some kind of vision without it?
Right. So those are both great questions. The first one regarding laser, unfortunately, used to be an easy answer, and now it's a little complicated. So surgery is done to remove cataracts by an ultrasound. It's just sound waves that removes the lens from the eye, breaks it up, and then you vacuum it up. These days, there does exist a laser that people use in conjunction with all the normal ultrasound and other parts of the surgery they do. The laser, all it does is make some incisions for you on the cornea and the front of the lens. It does not remove the cataract. Therefore, the question with the laser is this, is whether or not adding that part adds any sort of improvement in the end result. And so far, there has not been any evidence in any study to show that. The only difference that using the laser for you right now has been shown to do is it will cost you a lot more money. So the traditional cataract surgery without a laser is the way that most people go at this point. As far as what lens to implant in the eye, that's also a little bit of a complicated question. 90 to 95% of people get the traditional lens implant, meaning you remove the cataract and you implant a plastic lens that gets you nice and clear vision at distance. You do have the option to also instead focus things at near. The part where it gets confusing these days is there are other variety of lenses, what they call premium lenses, that try to get you back both distance and near vision in order to have you less dependent on glasses, but they too are not covered by insurance, so will cost extra, and there is a trade-off there.
How much?
It can cost anywhere, depending on the doctor, anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000 to $2,500 per eye, depending on who you're going to.
For the fancy ones.
Yes.
And if you use a fancy one in the left eye, you'll have to get a fancy one in the right eye.
That's right. And whether or not that is worth it for you is the real question, because you want to make sure you're spending money on something that you understand. There is a trade-off. More costing you more money does not mean better vision. It means you're deciding to make a trade-off, saying, you know, I want to have a little bit of reading vision and a little bit of distance vision, willing to pay that extra money. But I understand both are not going to be as crisp as they would be otherwise with a single vision glass.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Will there be vision? Will there be vision without the lens?
Oh, that's an excellent question that sometimes is confusing. You should not get no lens implanted. If you got no lens implanted, you have to wear the thickest glass you can possibly imagine in your mind that would weigh 10 pounds and give you very poor vision. So you must have. That's the way they used to have to do before they had the plastic
lenses.
Did.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Right. Okay. And here's one we got over the internet. I am 63, legally blind, with 20/400 in my right. No vision in the left eye. I have a cataract that is getting worse. This sounds awful. Mm-hmm. I am reluctant to commit to surgery having only one good eye. I have heard of a drop. That's just what you were talking about.
Right.
The phony drops.
Right.
That can alleviate the need for surgery. Can you expand on this? Well, you already talked about the fact that there are out there people trying to con you, right?
Right. So there's drops for floaters and there's drops for cataracts, and both of them are phony, unfortunately. And always the misconception is that the eye doctor wouldn't want there to be a drop for cataracts because then they wouldn't be able to do cataract surgery. And honestly, nothing could be further from the truth. If we could just give an eye drop, believe me, we have other things we could be doing. But as far as the question for—
One eye. He's got one eye.
One eye. And the question really is, which I guess we won't have the answer to, is if that vision is how it is in the one eye only because of the cataract, meaning nothing else is going on in the eye, just the cataract, well, then it's certainly worth pursuing and discussing with someone the risks and benefits of that and finding something that you feel exceedingly confident in that specializes in the removal of complex cataracts, is what we call that when a lot of other things are going on in the eyes, which makes it a little more anxiety-provoking, a little more stressful for you, and perhaps a different technique to be used by the surgeon.
Okay, we'll go to Andrew. Andrew, is this your first call? Is this your first call today?
Yes.
Okay, great.
I just kept getting disconnected. I'm sorry.
Gotcha. No, that's no problem. Go ahead.
I have two really quick questions. First, do you see a growing epidemic with screens and people looking at them and vision loss, you know, a correlation there? And also, are there any exercises you can do to repair vision loss? Thank you.
Stay there.
So the first question is one we get a lot regarding screens that are being used, iPad, any sort of computer screens, phones constantly. And the thought for a long time was that there is absolutely no effect on the vision. However, there's starting to become some studies that are showing if children are using these screens constantly, well, then the eyes become more nearsighted as they grow up. The eyes kind of
Nearsighted means you can't see far away.
Exactly. Okay. So they become focused on the distance that you are doing most of the time. So the kids that are on the phones or the iPads or the computer screens, the eyes more and more are becoming nearsighted, perhaps. That's what some preliminary evidence may be showing. So as far as exercises go in terms of that, the exercise would be exercise, period. Go outside. Don't be on your screen all the time.
Exercise, good judgment.
Go do something else for a little while. Don't be on the computer screen all the time. But there's no exercise otherwise for any other problems or anything beside for very particular trouble with kids with eye turning of very specific types. There is one type of exercise you can do, but for any other eye problem, there is no exercise that we really have to recommend.
Okay, and thank you to Andrew for that call. And now we'll go to Marie in Lake George. Okay, Marie, you're on.
Hello, doctor.
Yep.
I fell at one time at forward and hit my my forehead. Ever since then, I cannot stand sunlight. I can't stand light. It just burns my eyes. I have to wear sunglasses for everything that's white. Could that be an inflammation of my eye? I've been to eye doctors, retinal specialists, and nobody knows what it is. Would you know what it is?
Well, it's a little hard to put those symptoms together with hitting the forehead, something of that sort. But so it may or may not be related, but sensitivity to light, one of the most common reasons for that is dryness of the eyes. So you want to make sure, sometimes it can be quite subtle, make sure that that's not being missed. Inflammation in the eye is something that would be fairly hard to miss for the ophthalmologist.
Well,
but
no, I go to an ophthalmologist, and mm-hmm. I've gone to a retina specialist, mm-hmm. and I've had a CT scan, and neurologist. Nobody, they said they've never seen anything like it in their life, and they don't know what it is.
Well, it's a little tough one without examining, but we'd love to take a look and try to figure out what that sensitivity to light is, because it's one of the most common issues, actually, that people come in for, and we usually can find a reason why we're having that light sensitivity, whether it be something on the surface of the eye, something inside the eye, or the back of the eye like you're referring to. There should be a reason that we can at least help alleviate some of that.
And wait a second, Marie. How does somebody get in touch with you?
I've gone to a retinal specialist, and they take photos of the eye the minute that you walk in. I said, can't you see the back of the eye? But, yeah, they said there's nothing weak. The eyes, there's nothing wrong with the eyes. But I'm wondering if it could be inflammation of the optic nerve.
Well, these are some of the things that you've mentioned, a couple of them that possibly could give you the symptoms. So certainly you can come by and visit us. It's 845-896-9280.
But I'll have to get that down.
Well, we can't do that now, Marie, because we got a lot of people behind you. But
the number. Could someone repeat that
okay,
for me?
Real fast.
845.
Let's see. 8. Oh, I can't write it.
I'm sorry, Marie. I wish we...
845. I got that. Yeah.
896.
896.
92.
80. 80. And where is this?
That's in Fishkill, New York. You can make one visit to us, and hopefully we can help you out. It's a little tough to... That's a complex one to try to figure out over the phone.
It's a long way from Lake George. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go. And 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We have two free phones. Let us go to Laura in Boston Spa, I guess. Or Boston something. Okay, go, Laura. You're on.
Hi, doctor. Yes, I have a question about dry eyes. I've been diagnosed with dry eyes, and I'm currently trying Restasis. I've only been on it for about a month or so, and you know, maybe it's kind of helping a little bit. Can you just talk a little bit about dry eyes?
Sure, I'd love to. That's one of the things I work on most and something that I'm actually a bit passionate about because it's one of these underdiagnosed things. And when it is diagnosed, you've hit on another issue a little bit that I have is everyone tries to treat everyone the same way with dry eyes. So the first question we'd have is what's the reason you have dry eyes? Do you know that?
No, I am postmenopausal, and I understand that sometimes women who are postmenopausal, that can be a problem for them.
Certainly.
But that's all I really can contribute.
Okay, certainly. So that is one of the risk factors for dry eyes. So when people come to visit me, it seems a bit extreme, but I give them a whole packet. It's about 10, 15 pages to fill out with lists all the risk factors for dryness that they go through, hopefully before the visit, and mail in. Because one of the keys to dry eye is figure out why a person has it. And then there's a lot of different treatments we have that we can do according to why the person has dry eyes. And my pet peeve a little bit is that I get sent in a lot of referrals for dry eyes, and every single person is on Restasis because it's the only prescription medicine. And once the doctor says, oh, they're a little dry, here's Restasis, they decide that's going to be the treatment for you regardless of what the issue is. I have people that have had lid surgery that can't close their eyes fully, and they're on Restasis. You could put the person on Restasis forever. It would not do anything for them. So in brief, Restasis was made for a very particular problem initially called Sjogren's syndrome that causes dry eye, which it works quite well for. And I find spotty success with other issues. And you have to be on, as you know, I'm sure, at least 3 months to see if it works.
Laura, we got to take a break. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. Right.
Bye-bye.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Nathan Littower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, now offering new MRI technology with silent MRI scans and feet-first exams, NLH.org. Mass Mocha in North Adams, Massachusetts, presenting Roomful of Teeth on August 28th and live comedy with Solomon Giorgio on August 29th, massmocha.org. The Daily Hampshire Gazette, providing news and information for Hampshire County in print and online, gazettenet.com. And from Gothic Inn, Block Island, Rhode Island, a Victorian bed and breakfast perched high overlooking Crescent Beach. A short walk from the town and the ferry, dogs are welcome. TheGothicInn.com.
Dogs are welcome. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. But save your fingers for a moment because all the phones are ringing. All right, we'll go to Jill in Waterford. Okay, Jill, go ahead.
Hi. This may be the dry eye show here. I have the same thing that the previous caller had. At least that's how I was diagnosed. I suffer from profuse tearing. Anytime it's cold or any kind of breeze, no matter how slight, my eyes tear like I'm crying. And I'm a very active person, and in some situations, to have my eyes tearing like that can be very dangerous. So I've been under the care of an ophthalmologist. She has done about three different procedures, and the fourth, she put me on Restasis. Nothing has worked. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, is this the way it is, or,
is
there
possible?
Any other options?
Right.
Okay, go ahead, doctor.
So that, first of all, the tearing with dry eyes is one of the things that gets confusing us too, because people tell me, oh, they tear, and I say, oh, you may have dry eye, and they think I misheard them. They say, no, I tear a lot. But it's that eye trying to compensate for how dry it is, so it gets tearing, as you well know, to try to compensate and constantly tearing all day long. So I would pose to you and anyone that's concerned about the dry eye the same question I did with the last caller is, what is the reason for the dry eye? And if one doesn't have a firm answer to that question, then the jury is still out on whether it can be fixed, because oftentimes I find that the absolutely wrong issue is being addressed in terms of why the person has dry eye. And when you hone in on what the actual issue is, they do quite well. And I will give a quick example of someone that called into the program last time I was on, who was suffering from extreme dry eye for 10 years and came in to see me at the office. And it was clear that she just had an intense reaction to one of her glaucoma eye drops that she was on. We took her off of those drops. She had come in with red, painful eyes, irritated, tearing all the time. Came back a month later, and I thought it was a different person. She had no redness, no tearing, no irritation, and it was just an allergy to an eye drop. So not a chronic condition that she has to live with for the rest of her life. So really taking the time to, like I said, do that questionnaire that I have, coming in and discerning what the reason for the dry eye is, certainly is key.
Jill from Waterford, thank you. Okay, let's go to, is it Kathy from Otis? Kathy from Otis, is that you?
No, Alan, it's Patty. How are you?
Hi, dear. Thank you.
Hi, doctor. I was calling with a question regarding contact lenses that are worn at night to sort of reshape the eye so you don't have to wear glasses or lenses during the day. My niece has worn those for years so that she doesn't have to wear glasses during the day, and the doctor told her, you know, that's not going to be a permanent solution, but every day it will reshape at night just to keep your eyesight good. How this relates to me is because of a physical issue, I sleep only on my right-hand side for the last 17 years, and so my right side of my head, my eye is, you know, kind of smashed into the bed and the pillow, and my left eye is perfect eyesight, and my right eye is getting worse and worse. And I'm thinking that I'm, you know, changing the shape of my eye by all this pressure every night for 17 years. Is that possible, and is wearing those kind of contacts at night something that might be helpful for me?
Well, certainly that story that you tell is something we're still looking into a lot. It recently was found, and maybe this doesn't pertain to you, that people that constantly sleep on one side or have that one eye pushed up against the pillow are maybe at higher risk of glaucoma in one eye than the other. So certainly the brief answer would be why your vision's changing certainly needs to be investigated to determine what the reason is. If it's purely just a glasses prescription is changing, then sure, one of the options for you, of course, is glasses. One option is contact lens during the daytime. And I want to differentiate what you're bringing up, contacts at night, from just the average contact at night. The soft contact lens that everyone you know wears contact lenses, that contact lens should never be worn at night. Incredibly high risk of dangerous infections that can damage your vision for life. So you're talking about, for the rest of the listeners, something very specific called orthokeratology, which is a hard lens that's specifically made for nighttime use. And that being said, has to have immaculate care of that lens in order to prevent infection. So it's only for a very tiny number of people to do that. It works sort of like a retainer, like you're saying. You put it in at night, it shapes the lens. It shapes the front of the eye, the cornea, and that lens shapes that cornea so that during the day your prescription is correct and you don't need glasses or contacts during the day. As you leave it out, the effect wears off, much like a retainer. So it's for very specific people and very specific problems, and we'd have to see exactly what's going on with your eyes to see if that was a useful option.
Thank you, Patty.
Great. And that, just to go to the glaucoma thing, I do get tested, you know, every year, and it's not that, and it's only my right eye that's changing. Mm-hmm. So do you work with those corrective contacts? And
yes.
You do? Okay. So I did mention it to my eye doctor, and he was, I don't think he was familiar with them that much, because
right.
He was just like, I don't see that being, you know, an issue for you. But I feel because of the fact that I'm changing the shape of my eye every night, that it might, you know, be helpful.
It might be something to think of for you, and that's a very particular case where I actually think that may be worth thinking about, whereas we don't use those lenses that frequently, but in particular situations like this, it may be appropriate, obviously, depending on the exam.
Right. Okay,
okay,
Patty.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Okay, and that, of course, leaves us with Chris. Okay, Chris in Sandgate, Vermont. Chris, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call, and it's a pleasure to speak to both of you. I have a lot of eye issues, but my left eye is more than partially blind, and it happened when I had a retina detachment. And the contents were emptied and filled with a certain type of oil. In normal cases, this oil, gravitates toward the back of the eyeball to press against the retina to hold it in shape, in place. But mine, it went to the front, damaged the cornea. And since you guys were talking about the internal corneal transplants, I wondered if I was might be a decent candidate for something like that.
Right. So that would require, of course, an exam, too, to see which part of the cornea is damaged. Certainly, the oil does tend to damage the back surface of the cornea if it sits up against it, and that may be the only issue there. So if we look at the cornea and see 90% of it is fine, but that very back 10% there, that tiny layer in the back is the issue, then that would be what would be replaced. The question, of course, would be how healthy in the end is the retina, because you wouldn't want to go through a cornea replacement or cornea transplant surgery only to have the surgeon tell you, wow, the cornea looks terrific, it looks great, and then tell you you still cannot see because that retina is too unhealthy. So that has to try to be discerned prior to going through a large surgery like that.
Yeah, I remember what my eyesight was like just before it happened, and there was kind of a little black hole, this, I don't know, where everything was kind of going into this vortex, and it was definitely annoying.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Chris, we got to let you go. There are a lot of people with so little time left. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, let's go to Ted in Shelburne. Okay, Ted, you're on.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm 75, have been a glaucoma suspect, so-called, for some time. I've never had high pressure. I recently, and there is some nerve damage. It's interesting that you've mentioned the differential of which side you sleep on. As it can relate. And I'm changed eye drops. I had Alphagan, is it 0.1? And
yes.
Now I'm doing a generic
Brimonidine?
There you go. Mm-hmm. 1.5 or 0.15, mm-hmm. which was said to be not a problem. And it's partly because it's generic, although it's still wicked expensive. Well, I guess you could run a little bit with that. Is it fine to be doing what I'm doing? And this is three times a day.
Sure. Well, if the question is regarding brand versus generic drops, as one of the things that people should know about anyway, is there can be a significant difference sometimes between those medicines, particularly eye drops. They're very complex to make. So we have a whole list in our mind of ones I would never replace with the generic and ones that you could replace. The trouble with the Brimonidine as a generic compared to Alphagan is people tend to get an allergy much more frequently to the generic form of it. And once you do, you cannot use any of the Alphagans or Brimonidines ever again. The allergy just causes intense redness, swelling, irritation, not dangerous, but then excludes you from using the drop again, which sometimes limits your options.
Thank you, Ted.
And the intensity is okay. But I'm from just what you've said, I'm thinking Alphagan is my better bet.
That's right, and I completely understand the cost issues that unfortunately come up in this day and age regarding insurance and that sort of thing. But my preference is usually use that Alphagan P 0.1%, which is the brand name. I have obviously nothing to do with the company or anything like that.
So how much does that cost?
Well, it's variable on your insurance. You know, to me, in this day and age, it's very difficult. I can send one person over to the pharmacy, and they say, wow, doc, you said it'd be expensive. It was $10. The next person can say, hey, doc, are you crazy? I don't have $300 for a drop. So it's so unpredictable this day and age that it's really something that we have trouble with.
Ted, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Right. Okay, we'll go to Akasha in Ashfield. Okay, Akasha, you're on.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Hi, thank you so much for being there, both of you. And Alan, I will try to be quick.
Okay. I'm sorry. I know how it sounds, but, you know, everybody wants to get on. And
no, I know. So I definitely will try.
Then I get into my office and the red light is on. Somebody's cursing me out for being a jerk.
Don't listen to him. Yeah. Just pull your New York attitude up. Don't listen to him.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So I was recently diagnosed with Sjogren's.
Yes, that's right.
And I'm a little confused. My ophthalmologist that I went to, because my allergist sent me to him, said that, I said, so do I have it? And he said, well, you definitely have dry eyes. Like the left eye, they couldn't get any tears in the time allotted, so they tried longer. Mm-hmm. And he said, but everybody has dry eyes nowadays. So I said, well, I have a lot of neurological diseases like neuropathies, and I do get that malar rash like mm-hmm. they have in...
Lupus?
What's that disease?
Lupus?
Thank you. So what should I do? And he said, well, you need to get these drops. I'll give you a prescription, and I'll give you some samples because I can't afford the Systane.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's only a little money, but I'm on SSDI.
No, it's quite expensive, actually, those drops.
Yeah, so I get it once a month, so that cuts into my food budget, but they only last like a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to know, one, what kind of doc takes care of Sjogren's on the neurological level, two, with an ophthalmologist because I want to go see one that knows his stuff mm-hmm. or hers. How do I screen when I call? Mm-hmm. And should I see the ophthalmologist first
right.
to make sure it's what I have?
Well, generally speaking, the general doctor that would be appropriate for Sjogren's syndrome is a rheumatologist. This is a doctor that deals with the rest of the body, not referring to the eyes at this point. So you certainly want to have a rheumatologist on board, and you certainly want to know that you carry the diagnosis. I assume a blood test has been done that has shown
that. He only did the slit testing.
The ophthalmologist.
Yeah.
So the only way to diagnose someone with Sjogren's syndrome, and we do this test in our office, but you can see if there's an office nearby that does it, or the rheumatologist, is with a blood test. The particular test that I find most helpful these days is called the SHO test. It's S-J-O, and it just is one test that tests, it's a blood test that tests you for every possible thing in your blood that would indicate whether or not you have Sjogren's syndrome, and additionally, it tests for lupus and other autoimmune diseases, which often come together, unfortunately. So you want to have on board a ophthalmologist, preferably a cornea specialist, who will do the proper testing and do the SHO test, S-J-O test, along with a rheumatologist to guide you with the rest of your systemic possible related signs and symptoms.
And how accurate is the SHO test? Because I tend to have diseases that don't always show up in the blood work.
Right. It's very, very accurate. It's almost going overboard because it allows me to detect very, very early subtle cases, which is great, but sometimes bothersome, of course, to people. What do I do with this at this point? I don't have any symptoms yet, or I just have a tiny bit of dryness, and it's just something to certainly be aware of. There's varying degrees of Sjogren's. Thankfully, there's very, very mild, which will not affect people very much, and then, of course, the other extreme. So knowing whether or not the diagnosis there is appropriate and important. And the SHO test is the best test that's out there right now. It detects very, very early cases.
Thank you, Akasha. Okay. Sorry, I'm just trying to get everybody in here. Jillian in Del Mar. Jillian, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about wet and dry macular degeneration, what the difference is between the two, and if there are any scientific breakthroughs or medications for either.
Sure. That's a very important question. It affects a lot of people. There's dry and wet macular. Macular degeneration refers to the retina, the back surface of the eye. The very center of the retina is the macula. It can either start to break down and get rough over time, or related to certain other issues. That's the dry type, where the tissue just starts to get rough and stop working as well. Wet means there's actually been bleeding in the macula, in the center of the retina. They're treated very differently. Dry, sunglasses, vitamins called AREDS2, AREDS2, are very important. If your primary doctor says those vitamins are okay, you want to follow up with your medical doctor and your ophthalmologist, of course. And the dry type, we're still working on better actual medical treatments to prevent it from progressing, but those vitamins do help. The wet type, there is actual medicine that goes inside the eye, an injection of medicine when a bleeding episode happens. That's important to do as quickly as possible.
Thanks, Jillian. Okay, let's go to Heather in Kinderhook. We're really running out of time now, Heather, so you got to be quick.
Hi. My question is about LASIK surgery. I had LASIK surgery, monovision type. I had it corrected. My vision near my distance vision was corrected only in one eye, and that's worked really well for me for a long time. However, as I've aged, my eyes have deteriorated naturally, and I'm wondering if I should think about another round of LASIK or if another course would be preferable.
So whether or not to undergo that, of course, is completely up to you, depending on how you feel your vision is day to day. Sometimes you can repeat LASIK treatment. Sometimes you cannot, depending on how much of a treatment was necessary the first time. And only you can tell that by seeing the ophthalmologist and getting some imaging done at the ophthalmologist. Two is if there's any early cataracts or changes in the lens causing that change in vision, you'd want to know about it because you wouldn't want to go doing LASIK if the actual problem was there's a little bit of cataract coming in. And that's the issue the doctor would have to discern whether or not it's just a simple change in the prescription or something else going on in the eye.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Now we have two very quick over the internet questions for you, Doc. And we are almost out of time. In fact, we are out of time. I can't go any further. And I'm so sorry to Sue in Boston Spa and to Martha, who called and who are not going to get their questions answered today, as are not Richard is calling and on the internet, and Steve in Westfield. So sorry, just out of time. Thank you, everybody. Thanks to Dr. Daniel Brox for joining us. For more information on Dr. Brox and his practice, visit WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Support for Medical Monday comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive cardiac, neurology, oncology, and emergency care services, reinventing healthcare one patient at a time, EllisMedicine.org. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Baloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned for a news update.